fire can take your life before you know it. It can take your home, your car, and your loved ones. For a century and a half, a certain kind of person has signed up to fight fire in Kansas City and to try to keep catastrophe at bay. I'm Munro Dodd, and on today's Central Standard, we'll talk about fire, the kind of fire that has destroyed buildings and lives, as well as the firefighters whose job it has been to minimize the damage. From the bucket brigades of pre-Civil War days to the modern, sophisticated machinery of today, the Kansas City Fire Department has had to endure and adapt to battling brutal blazes and blistering budgets. We'll learn about the rich history of fire and firefighting in our town ahead on Central Standard after the news. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard Friday. I'm Munro Dodd. Fire. It can cook our food and heat our homes and even light our way, but when it goes bad, it goes very, very bad. We all know the results. Burns, charred wood, ruined buildings, loss of skin and limbs and life. For more than a century and a half, Kansas City has had to find a way to fight fire when it threatens us, our loved ones, and our property. Most of those years, that work was done by the Kansas City Fire Department. Its history is filled with danger and excitement. With us today are three men, who know a lot about the long history of fires and the fighting of them in Kansas City. Ray Elder is historian of the Kansas City Fire Department. Jimmy Walker is a battalion chief who's also vice president of the Kansas City Fire Historical Society. And Matt Stegall is a firefighter and official of the union. Gentlemen, welcome to Central Standard Friday. Now, fires we have always with us, but they were more numerous when Kansas City was young, weren't they? We're talking the 1850s and 1860s.
1850s and 1860s was your bucket brigade. We didn't become a fire department until 1868.
And in those days of the bucket brigade, you were just passing water from one person to the next in hopes you could get some part of the fire out.
Yes, until it got burnt down, then they walked away from it. Very seldom did this work, and people didn't like the bucket brigades. It took them away from their work. They wanted a new fire department. They started action in about 1866. Come forward from there, and we'll go on from there.
Well, Ray Elder, you do know a lot of facts and figures about the Kansas City Fire Department. It's great that you do. It's great that someone keeps that history around. The fire department then was a post-Civil War invention?
Yes. For Kansas City, in March of 1867, the city of Kansas City decided they wanted to organize or start a fire department. So their first job was to find a person who they could be our fire chief, and that man happened to be a gentleman by the name of Francis M. Foster.
Mm-hmm.
He accepted the volunteer position. In August of 1867, Kansas City placed an order for a steam fire engine, two hose wagons with 500 feet of hose each, with the Silby Manufacturing Company in Seneca Falls, New York. The order was placed, and the city had to figure out how they was going to pay for this. Well, they come up with the idea that delinquent property, real estate property in Kansas City, would be sold for their taxes. Well, this done, and just prior to the equipment arriving, two injunctions were placed in the Jackson County courts stopping this action. They had no way to pay for this equipment. So a gentleman by the name of John Campbell, he was a city councilman, stepped forward with $5,500 and paid for our equipment.
Uh-huh.
Our equipment arrived on March the 12th, 1868, and for 2 days it was put on display in the market house area for all the citizens to see.
Uh-huh. The city market.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And at 2 p.m. on Sunday, March the 14th, they had to perform performance tests to see if the steamer would do what it would do.
Yeah.
Say,
uh-huh.
They passed with flying colors. So at 4:56 p.m., Chief Foster signed over and took ownership of the steamer John Campbell, number one, and the equipment. So March the 14th, 1868, at 4:56 p.m., is the birthday of the Kansas City Fire Department.
So naming rights are nothing new with football and baseball stadiums today.
Not hardly.
John Campbell paid for it. He got his name on it.
Yes, and it carried on through the years. The only persons that got a free ride was we normally named our hook and ladders after former chiefs.
Uh-huh.
But if you wanted to have your name on a steam fire engine, it would cost you about half the price of a steam fire engine.
Okay, now these steamers we're talking about, I've seen them in movies and period pieces. There's a big cylinder in the middle of a wagon drawn by horses, and it's puffing away. That was to pump water?
That was strictly to pump water. It also had another wagon went with it. It was called the hose wagon.
Uh-huh.
It was a two-piece operation. You could not do one without the other.
Yeah.
There was three men on the steamer. Normally, the hose wagon could have as many as 5 or 15 men on it, all men that could get on there. But this was in the volunteer days.
Yeah.
Now, when they started a paid fire department, there was normally 4 men on that hose wagon.
I got to ask you a question. I've always wondered, those steamers, they come steaming out of the firehouse with smoke going and everything. How did they make the steam up so fast?
Well, basically, in the really start, they would have that in the firebox. They would have the materials all laid there, and all they would do is when the bell rang, they would pour kerosene or gasoline or some kind of fluid on it, light it. And by the time they got to the fire, they was able to start pumping water, and the fire just kept going and going. If you could get 5 minutes, you'd have all the steam you needed to pump all the water you wanted.
Now, fires were a different, I don't know if they're a different animal in those days, but they certainly started in some of the darndest places on the days before electrical codes or even electricity. There were materials and codes and other things were primitive compared to today's, weren't they?
Go ahead, Jim.
Oh, yes, they were. Building materials have changed a lot in the time since the fire department started to now. You know, currently there's a lot more synthetics. Things burn faster and hotter than they did then.
Yeah, faster and hotter, but also a little bit more poisonous today, right?
Yes, correct.
Mm-hmm. And in those days, I remember reading about a people who'd put candles on their Christmas tree. And the Christmas tree, of course, if somebody was clumsy, could burn up and the house could go in no time.
Well, they started that in England, and it come forward over to America.
But even the earliest electric lights on Christmas trees were crudely done.
Yes. They caused many a fire. And we was having problems with Christmas trees as late as 1940, 41 during World War II. That was a main thing that bothered a gentleman here who was our director of the fire department, a guy by the name of Francis Brick Warnell. He wanted to outlaw lights on Christmas trees.
Ooh, that's like outlawing Santa Claus, isn't it?
He didn't win.
We still have problems with real Christmas trees to this day. I mean, if they're not kept properly and they don't keep them with water, then we still have that problem. And we try to educate the public every year on safety with Christmas trees.
Because they dry out and they're
dry out and they catch on fire really quick and burn fast.
Yeah, they go up like a Roman candle.
I bet they do. I think I saw a demonstration on TV once of an aged Christmas tree and a guy lighting it. Opera houses, theaters. Theaters were places where lots of fires seemed to have occurred, or maybe they were just noticed. Because those were the days even before asbestos, right? Right.
Yeah. We had one opera house here in Kansas City. In fact, we had two. One was called the Coates Opera House, burnt in 1901. The other one was called the Willis Wood Theater. It burned in 1917. The cause of these fires were never discovered, but let me tell you, there was nothing there to investigate. They burnt right to the ground. One of the unique things about both of these buildings, they were connected to another building by a tunnel under the street. You could go into the Coates Hotel, go downstairs, and go northwest in a tunnel and come up on the northwest corner in the Coates Opera House.
Mm-hmm.
The same for the Willis Wood Theater and the Brunswick Hotel, a Baltimore hotel. There was a tunnel that you never have to go outside if you come to Kansas City and stay in those hotels.
In the late 19th century, too, before the widespread use of electric lighting, and electric lighting, as we just discussed, has its own flaws, there was gas lights and candles and kerosene and just all manner of ways to get a fire started if you weren't careful.
We actually lost a firefighter in Kansas City in 1906. He was in the top of what we call the Studebaker building at that time, We now call it the Stowe Hardware Building, and it's got another name presently. But he actually kicked over a gas valve up there while on watch at night and opened this valve and didn't know it. He asphyxiated himself. So about 3 o'clock in the morning, he was going to be relieved. Well, here comes the relief man, and we're talking 14 stories up in the air. Here comes the relief man. He opens the door. Now we have a major fire in the watch office. Instead of going down one flight and calling the fire department, the young man was so scared, he ran all 14 floors and ran 2 blocks to a local fire station that turned the fire in. Needless to say, the young man that was up there was dead before the fire started.
Well, that's another thing. But telephones didn't come around until the 1880s, and not many people had them. Only a few businesses did, so alerting the fire department was a problem, too.
Actually, we was working with the telephones in 1879.
Oh, really? Okay.
That early for us. And they was our major backbone in those days. The telephone really played a very important part in our turning in of alarms.
We're all accustomed to seeing fire hydrants in our neighborhoods and downtowns and other places today. But in those earliest years, they were not common or didn't even exist. Where did the water – tell us how the evolution of getting water to fight
fires. Okay, the water sources before fire hydrants were your cisterns in your – where your water would come off of your roofs. The fire department could go into them. They actually had 17 or 18 cisterns in Kansas City in the streets that they would fill after fires. And these would carry about 20 to 25,000 gallons of water. Then there was an extremely large amount of small and large ponds in the downtown Kansas City area.
And these were just ponds that had collected rainwater.
Right.
Yeah.
And they had, every one of them had a name, the Broadway Pond, the Ransom Pond, the Sheridan Pond.
And so the fire department knew these by name and could just go dip one end of the hose in it and have the steamer pump the...
Right. You took a hard section, laid it in there with a strainer on the end of it into the pond, and pump it, either pump it dry or put the fire out. And then you wait for Mother Nature to fill it up.
Now, it wasn't in the 1870s we got a waterworks and thus a underground water lines and so forth?
We passed an ordinance in 1873. And by 1875, we was running water in hydrants and in homes in Kansas City.
You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd, and we're talking about firefighting in Kansas City over the last century and a half. We already have an email, one from Frank, who says, seems there was a fire station on 10th Street that claimed to be the first to have a fire pole. Is this where the fire pole originated, Kansas City?
10th Street. I cannot place a fire station that had a fire pole to be the first. Kansas City's first would probably be station number 4, and it would be at about southwest corner of 14th and Penn. This would be 1877. Uh-huh. Now, the fire pole was not new. Actually, St. Joseph, Missouri had the first fire pole in this area, and it was a hickory tree that they cleaned the bark off and took a shave knife and shaved everything off. Then they waxed it with pig's grease, wiped it down, and that's what they slid up and down the pole on.
And good luck to the firefighters, they don't get a splinter.
Well, the splinters didn't come about.
That's great.
But going into that, there were 3 different types of poles. One was a steel pole, uh-huh. One was a galvanized pole, and one was a brass pole.
Is there a question you have about the history of the Kansas City Fire Department? You can join our conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org, or you can tweet us. Our handle is KCURCST. The most glorious moments in the 19th century for the fire department seem to have happened when a guy named George Hale came along and headed up the force. Am I right about that?
Yes. George Hale actually came with the fire department on November the 14th, 1871, and he was about the third man to operate the steamer John Campbell. He was promoted chief of the Kansas City Fire Department on May the 1st, 1882, and a gentleman by the name of James A. Reed seen to it that he kept his promise and fired him on March the 22nd of 1902.
Yes.
We fired the most famous man in the world.
Politics happened then just as it does today.
we were starting. That was the very beginning of our political political career we're getting into right here.
You're hearing Ray Elder, a longtime Kansas City fireman and historian of the fire department, and we're joined here today by Ray and Jimmy Walker and Matt Stegall, both of whom are firefighters and interested in the history of the fire department. George Hale had an almost performance troupe of firefighters. They were so good at this stuff, and people like to watch them. Tell us about those guys.
Well, why George Hale in Kansas City was chosen was not because they drilled the best in the world, but because of an invention of George C. Hale. He invented the swinging harness. This harness would let you get out of an engine house in as little as 8.5 seconds, which could not be done with the standard harness hanging on the wall that had to be put on the horses. Well, this is the way the United States had a ringer when they had sent George Hale to England. He come back world champion, and they also come back world champions from Paris, France in 1900.
I'm trying to visualize a swinging harness. The horse has no harness on it, but the harness can swing around. The horse walks into it or is led into it.
When the bell went off, the horse had an automatic halter strap on him. The bell went off. This strap disconnected. The horse ran up and was standing underneath this. He dropped it on the horse. Two snaps. Everybody was on the rig. Out the door you went. Now, I just mentioned 8.5 seconds. This was what won the championship in England. The closest time to that time was 1:17.5. The longest time was by Milan Italy, I believe. They took them 4 minutes and 30 seconds is what it was.
By which time the buildings in Milan, Italy were well engulfed, I'm sure, by the time they finished that.
Well, they come back in 1900 and challenged Kansas City. Mm-hmm. They was a runner-up in a contest, and the winner was going to be decided between Milan, Italy, and Kansas City, or the United States. The United States won, of course.
Yes. And so these were international contests. Yes. The European firefighters, and we sent guys to...
Right.
And the horses.
There was 21 countries from Europe and North America and South America.
We have a caller. Let's go to Stuart in Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning. Thank you, gentlemen. I wanted to verify a story I've heard about the New York Life Building being the tallest building in Kansas City with a 24-hour fireman posted at the top looking on the horizon for smoke and using a teletype to communicate to the firehouse. Is this a true story?
I have never come across that in my research. I can tell you about a fire watchtower, but it was not that building. There is a building on the corner of 8th and Truth called St. Patrick's Church. One of the top spires on the south side was a fire watchtower from before 1881 to about 1906.
Okay.
Well, Stuart, it's a nice-sounding story, and it sounds like it's related to one, but not quite on, at least according to the guy who knows the most about fire history in Kansas City, Ray Elder. Thank you.
I'm enjoying it very much. Thank you.
All right.
You're welcome.
Thanks for your call.
I think what Ray was saying about the horses, that we need to – those horses were extremely well-trained, and they were very, very valuable. So even on a regular fire, these horses would – as they responded, there was a man who would unhitch the horses and take them back to the station while the fire was going on. That was his sole job. And then he would come back to tend to the fire. So these horses were very, very valuable.
Right.
And weren't there some of these things that were actually like the hose and reel carts that were pulled by firefighters themselves?
Kansas City did try that. Our streets were too steep and for this to be done. We actually bought a hook and ladder. It was called the McGee Hook and Ladder Number 1. We come here in July of 1870. 3 months later, we figured out how to put a horse on the front of it because we could not pull it. And it was stationed at 16th and Grand. And if you'll just know Grand Avenue, it's an uphill street all the way.
Yes.
And you're pulling a truck up there. I don't care. They had about 30 men pulling this. When they got there, they just had to let somebody else do their work for them. So that's reason we don't have very many apparatuses that was pulled by hand.
Guys, in the tasks that are done by firefighters today and I guess all over time, how are tasks assigned? Are they assigned by strength or by aptitude or what? Or is there just a pick? You just draw straws.
Usually it's a position on the apparatus where you sit, where you're assigned. Everybody has a everybody has a place and part of the team. So, you know, the officer has a job, and like currently it's your riding position. So the person who sits behind the officer does a certain job. The person who drives does a certain job. It depends what apparatus you're on. It was the same then as it is now. Some of the jobs have changed.
Mm-hmm, of course.
Yeah, we don't have to worry about taking the horses back to the station. Yeah. It's all about where you sit. And everybody, I kind of described it, it's like a chaotic ballet. Everybody's busy. Everybody has a job and goes to work and works together in this amidst chaos.
Are those jobs assigned by seniority or by knowledge or passing tests? How are they assigned?
Well, I mean, obviously the officer's position is a test, and the driver's promotion as well. But the firefighter's positions are – usually they rotate daily. So you may be behind the officer one day. You may be behind the driver another day.
Okay, so you get a chance to do all of them.
May I mention an old thing we used to have on the fire department? As a firefighter or a driver, you know how to do your job below you, and you know how to do the job above you. And that's, I think, still carries out today in our department.
In a lot of respects, firefighting seems quite like being in the military, being in the infantry or something, knowing all the jobs, having to sometimes step into another job, and long periods of not doing anything, and then great periods of doing just a lot of stuff. Let's go to Ian in Marion, who has called. Good morning, Ian.
Hi. I just wanted to mention maybe your listeners would be interested in looking at a steamer that's in the Wyandotte County Museum. There's a little horse-drawn steamer in pretty good shape that's on display in that museum. And I also had another point about Chief Hale that your guests haven't mentioned, and maybe they've run into this, that he had a big fight with a National Water Works company in 1893 over the supply of water because the city had a contract with the National Water Works Company, which was an eastern company, and the city owed the Water Works Company $80,000, which was a lot of money in those days, and Chief Hale wanted to buy three steamers, and he claimed that there wasn't enough water getting out of the hydrants and buildings were being lost, and he needed the steamers to make up for that lack.
Ray, you've heard that story, I take it?
I've heard that story, but it wasn't three steamers. It was four steamers that Steve Hale purchased in 1893. And I know about the fight. I don't know exactly what the outcome of it was. I do have a book that I've read on this certain category, but it does not come to mind.
Okay, well, Ian, thank you very much for your call. The Chief Hale's departure, 1902, James A. Reed was the mayor, and James A. Reed not only has a road named after him, but he was a very powerful man who was a senator, ran for president, an incredible lawyer. He would have his way. How did he get at odds with George Hale?
When he was elected in 1901 as our mayor, he wanted to put in what they call a game well system for fire police. This is a ticker tape type machine.
Game well.
Game well, yes. Okay. George Hale would not support him on this. Well, he says at the next election, if you don't support me, I'll see to it that you're not our fire chief. And he kept his word.
And he came up with every reason in the world that George Hale was a bad fire chief.
Oh, yes. He had about seven charges against him. Insubordination. I tell you, the charges, I cannot remember them, but to me they were very, well, made-up charges. Because knowing the man by just reading about him, you know the man would not perform this way.
And knowing about James A. Reed, I would say that he was out to win no matter what the cost in matters of truth or
this
accuracy.
Is true.
It didn't really hurt Chief Hale after he was fired, because where did he go, Ray? He went to St. Louis for the World's Fair.
He went to St. Louis for what we call the St. Louis World's Fair.
Uh-huh.
He was there for 3 years putting on daily demonstrations, and he was also in charge of fire protection for the St. Louis World's Fair, backed up by the St. Louis Fire Department.
So his reputation exceeded just his job in Kansas City. Good.
We could spend the whole hour talking about Chief Hale, and Ray does. So.
Okay, well, let's go then to another caller. We have Jim in North Kansas City. Good morning, Jim.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Hey, I have a quick question based on family lore, if you will. I had an uncle who was a firefighter at one time, and I don't know the years in which he was, but there's a story that basically Walt Disney had a studio above a firehouse. He observed a mouse, and that became the basis for his drawings for Mickey Mouse. Do you know anything about that?
I'm sorry to report, I do not.
I've heard the story about observing the mouse, and that became Mickey. But I believe we may not be right next to a fire station when we did it. So, Jim, thanks very much for your call. You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm here with Ray Elder, Jimmy Walker, and Matt Stegall, all of or formerly of the Kansas City Fire Department. And after the break, we will be back to find out more about its long history and the history of fires and fighting them in Kansas City. You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. Welcome back to Central Standard Friday. I'm Monroe Dodd. We're discussing fires in Kansas City and who fights them. Our guests are Ray Elder, a longtime Kansas City firefighter and the historian of the Kansas City Fire Department. Also with us is Jimmy Walker, a battalion chief and vice president of the Kansas City Fire Historical Society, and Matt Stegall, a firefighter and a union official. Gentlemen, there is a display down at Union Station of a fire engine. Tell us a little bit about it.
We have a small museum space located on the lower level of Union Station across the hall from the Irish Museum. Mm-hmm. We have on display a 1919 American LaFrance pumper. It was restored by the Kansas City Fire Department. It is on loan. It's actually owned by the Kansas City Fire Department. We also have a 1927 Aaron's Fox pumper, but it's not on display down there. We have a chemical wagon, which was a small wagon and used to put out small fires. It was, Ray, you're going to have to help me on this one. It's like had soda acid.
Soda and acid. It's a soda and acid fire extinguisher on wheels.
And when you activate it, you would turn the soda acid. It would build up pressure inside the tank of water. And it's 50 gallons. Is that what it was, Ray?
Right.
50 gallons. It would, once you activated it, it was it. You were flowing water. And you had 50 gallons of water, it would be good for putting out smaller fires. It could arrive faster and first. So we have one of those on display. We also have an old hose cart that would have accompanied the steamer, like we talked about, on display down there. We're trying to raise funds to expand, to get bigger. It's a work in progress. How's that?
It's a work in progress. It's just like all our lives, I guess.
Not the best time to ask for money right now, or the last 2 years, so... But we're looking for a place to display this new. We completely restored a 1927 Aaron's Fox back to showroom, like it rolled off the line. And we're looking for a place to expand and put that on display. In 1927, I'm going to defer to Ray. Was it nine?
We bought nine pumpers, six hose wagons, four aerials, and one service truck. In 1927, it took the Aaron's Fox Manufacturing Company a whole year to deliver all of that equipment.
And if I'm not mistaken, that order is the one that completely replaced the horses that we had on the fire department. We still had horses down in the West Bombs and the stockyards that were still pulling out fire engines in 1927. So, yeah.
Well, let's talk a second about some of Kansas City's bigger fires over time. And you mentioned the stockyards. In 1918, there was a big fire there that it was even blamed by some people on German saboteurs. So tell us about that fire.
It was not the stockyards. It was between 9th and 12th Street, Mulberry to Santa Fe, in that area.
In the West Bottom.
Right. Yeah, the German saboteurs were mentioned in this, but it turned out to be a fire that started at about 5:40 p.m. on May the 5th, 1918. The firebox of the switch engine is what caused this fire on a very windy day. The Kansas City Fire Department had almost all of their equipment down there. This fire burnt out roughly nine square blocks of that 12-block area.
This is a switch in, a railroad switch
engine. Railroad switch engine. The coals coming out of there caught grass and weeds on fire. Mm-hmm. Kansas City, Kansas was helping Kansas City, Missouri. It come about that the two gentlemen, these two chief officers, decided they was going to make a fire line by dynamiting and stopping some of these buildings. Fortunately, Mother Nature prevailed. She come in with a strong windstorm, and the local newspapers give Mother Nature the credit of putting out this fire.
And as I read on some of the information you have on the web, the fire chief was demoted right away.
That gentleman was named Mr. Coffee. I call him the 40-day wonder. He didn't quite make it 39 days as big chief. However, you have to know some background on this. The politics was plain. The Democrats were thrown out and the Republicans come in. Mm-hmm. There was no Republican fire chief officers from a district chief or a battalion or anything else. So they went down to and drafted a captain at station number 24 and promoted him chief of the Kansas City Fire Department. After that, he was demoted back to a captain of 24s. And then also he didn't like working on the fire department, so he became the mechanic of the fire department.
I recall from reading Kansas City history that that was a common thing in the early 1900s, for a Republican administration to come in and the Democratic administration to replace it, and back and forth. And each time that happened, workers, patronage jobs, police, and obviously now firefighters all changed in their supervision, all on politics.
There was one particular one, John C. Eckner. He knew that this was coming. He was the gentleman that was replaced by this John Coffey, or Edward Coffey. He actually went to what we call a fire insurance patrol. It was not under city politics. It was under a private organization. And, of course, he got that job and kept it for many a year. He would sit there and watch the people come and go.
If you have questions about the local history of the Kansas City Fire Department, call us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. You can also tweet us at KCURCST. And Melissa has emailed us asking, in the old days, who took care of the injured and disabled firefighters?
I have to know what she's talking about. Old days. Old days would be before, I'm going to say about 1880. They basically were left up and just taken to the normal hospitals. 1891, we established what we call the Martins Relief Association. This was an organization that would not only look after the firefighters, it also looked after their families and their children. And this stayed around until about 1949, this organization did. Then it was taken over by the insurance companies that the city now provides for medical needs for the people.
Okay, and what about firefighter retirement? That surely must have changed over the years. Everybody else
has.
Yes, it wasn't much. You stayed around until you were pretty old. And I mean, that's the truth.
He is correct. Our first pension system was passed in 1908. And at that time, if you had 20 years of service, you could go off at a set pension of $50 a month. As we went through and started going forward, that pension was reduced in the 30s down to $42.50 a month. After the Pendergast machine was thrown out, this pension went back to $50 a month. And in 1953, this pension system was done away with, and the new pension system that we are now under took over. And you was paying in 5% of our salary, and the city was paying in a sum bigger than that. But you had to have 25 years, and you would roughly get one half of your highest pay in the last 25 years that you worked.
Now, back in the matter of famous fires, in April 1900, the convention hall burned down. And sadly, Chief Hale's department could do nothing about it. Is that correct?
That's correct. I have not read a lot about this, but this fire happened so fast and so quick that nothing could really be done. Everything was against him, from the wind, directions, and everything else. it was just burnt down fast.
Yeah. Now, in 19, we talked about the West Bottoms fire. Moving forward, in 1978 is Kansas City's deadliest fire at the part of the Coates House that no longer exists. Right.
Right. That fire happened in January, I believe, January the 28th or January the 29th.
It was cold.
I would have been the first captain and the first engine on that scene had I been working. That fire was only two blocks from the fire station. Mm-hmm. I watched this fire happen on television. We lost 20 people at that fire.
Wow. Wow. Mostly residents of the hotel
yes,
at the time.
Right.
Okay, we have a caller now. Let's go to Patty in Kansas City. Good morning, Patty.
Put on the website.
Hello?
Hello. Hi, so I'm on the air.
You are, Patty. What's
All
your
right.
question?
In the process of researching some of my neighborhood in regards to its historic nature, oh, God, I sound so awkward, I learned about the Sanborn fire maps. They're fascinating. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
The way that everything used to be platted, the way that every building used to have, like, its entries and exits and its fire nature mapped on these maps. I wonder, how did firefighters use those? Did they have someone that studied them? And also, are maps like that still in use? And I'm going to go off the air now, okay?
Thanks, Patty.
Okay.
Sanborn fire maps. The ones that she's talking about, there's not a complete set that I can find here on Kansas City at certain times. I have seen them in use by the fire department over the years, but these tells you how many windows it has, how many stories it has, all the pertinent information you would want to know, but it was not carried by any of the chief officers that I can remember, Sanborn fire maps. Now, they did carry their own information many years ago.
In fact, Sanborn fire maps, which are a treasure for any local historian or
yes.
anybody looking to research their block if it's old enough, were initially made so that insurance companies wouldn't have to travel to a city to know what a building was made of before they insured the building against fire, as I understand.
Correct.
Uh-huh. So it was might have been of passing interest to Kansas to firefighters. Now, there was no GPS for years and years, and yet firefighters had to know when an address was called in. How hard was that for the people to do?
Well, I'll let Jim speak first, and I'll talk the old-timer.
Okay. Jimmy?
Well, I'll tell you what. When I came on the fire department, before you were allowed to drive, I had a captain. You had to know every 100 block before you were in. By 100 blocks, we, Walnut, Grand McGee. Walnut's one block east of Main. Grand's two blocks east of Main. You had to be aware. You had to know every single one of those before he would let you get behind the wheel and drive. And because it was expected of you that when an address came out in your district, you knew where it was.
And how far it was.
And how, well, right. And how, yeah. Not necessarily how far. You just had to know when they sent you.
Oh.
If you ran the wrong address, if you went the wrong way, God help you.
That might not help your career.
Well, yeah. It might not help your living situation for the next 24 hours while you're at the station or the next month while you're at the station. So it was expected of you to know where you were. Even currently, fire trucks, we don't have GPS on them.
Oh.
So we still have to go by your knowledge of the district and know how to get to whatever address they put out there. The technology's there. We just don't employ it in our city right now.
Somehow it's comforting to know that you still have to know where things are, depending on
electronics. The ambulances that are on the fire department, they have computer consoles in them, and so do the battalion chief cars. And that will show you maps of where you go and shows you where you are. And but it's best to know where you're going, still to know where you're going, because sometimes, technology fails, and that's a fallback is, your knowledge of your area.
Very good.
And I'm sure they did it back in Ray's day, too, but the first year you're on the fire department, you spend that time learning the 100 blocks, and every firefighter has a big three-ring binder, and you build a map book of your own district, and you learn all the streets and names. And I know I did it when I first came on, and we have guys now sitting out in the bay for hours studying their streets.
Because woe be to the person who doesn't know where West Paseo is, for instance.
It gets a little rough.
You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd. Melissa writes to us in an email, were there any particular ethnic groups that dominated the fire department early on or even now?
Ray's good at this one. He's
Well, we'll start out with the first ethnic group, you might say, would be the Irishmen. From them, after about 1920, in that era, there was really no ethnic groups that dominated. We kind of seemed to leveled out. And as people migrated from other countries like Vietnam and people places like that, they come on to the fire department, not in great amounts. But we have had everybody from, let's say, Arabs on our job, Orientals on the fire department. Mm-hmm. There's no domineering ethnic group in our department today.
But their tradition has, I mean, every ethnic group has left a mark on our department.
Right.
So, for instance, tradition on the fire department is on Sunday, you eat Italian food. Yeah. We make a big pot of sauce and meatballs. It's almost every fire station in the city, when you go, if you go at Sunday morning at 9 o'clock, you're going to smell garlic and onions, and it's just
correct.
The way it is. And on Saturdays, it's tradition to have Mexican food because there was a large Mexican, you know, group that came on the fire department. So it's traditions that we have like that have left their mark from every ethnic group, and it's embraced.
We mentioned earlier you have to have a really good knowledge of the area. Firefighters these days, and I don't know how long it's been true, I'd be interested to hear, have to know first aid pretty well, too, and medical things. Because every time there's a call anymore, it seems like the fire truck gets there before an ambulance does.
Correct.
Well, right now, the Kansas City Fire Department, since 2009, MAST and the KCFD have merged, as most people probably know by now.
Right.
And, you know, we have...
But even in other cities,
As the years have gone by, the fire departments have had to take on more and more roles.
Uh-huh.
And they've been the catch-all organization for most cities. Hazardous materials, you know, we've taken on, you know, we have extrication equipment for car wrecks, for, you know, emergency medical services. So, you know, it's just natural that there's been one of those sayings that have been that if you don't know who to call the fire department, because they'll show up. They'll mm-hmm. show up quickly and take care of whatever problem. And that's still the same way it is now. We have implemented an ALS pumper program, which is advanced life support. So we are currently, like a lot of cities in the country, we're placing paramedics on pumpers so that advanced life support can arrive even sooner. And then when the ambulance shows up, they can take over advanced life support care. So we're really trying to make emergency medical services a seamless flow of care.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, it's been that way with the fire department for years. We get called for everything from a water leak. to somebody smells something that's funny. We'll show up and, you know, we investigate. You know, we handle gas leaks. We handle on and on and on. You never know what your day's got in store.
Right.
To tell you about what Jimmy just talked about, what he was talking about in our advanced life support and stuff, basically this started under a guy by the name of Francis Brick Warnell in 1941. He put first aid kits in the fire chief's cars.
Hmm.
And then when they got more money, we started to put them on the pumpers. And then also in that period of time, everybody became what they call a first responder of American Red Cross gave this class to do this type of work. From there, we've come on up. But prior to that, the fire department didn't have any way to help anybody. If they got to a fire where somebody was burnt, they'd have to rely on the ambulance coming in to help them.
We've talked about a couple of the big fires in Kansas City history, and there were a couple of big occasions when Kansas City firefighters very catastrophically suffered death. And I can think of 1959 along Southwest Boulevard and 1988 out on US 71. Some people around, many of us around today, remember the ones in 1988. Tell us about the one in 1959.
It was August 18th, 1959. We lost five Kansas City firefighters, three of them off of pumper 19 and two of them off of pumper 25, and one citizen. This was caused by a gasoline explosion. It happened due to the fact that there was a problem, a leak in this when they was filling a tanker truck to go out and fill to take gas to gasoline stations.
Mm-hmm.
I think static electricity is the main cause of this, but it was not even a Kansas City fire to start with. It was a Kansas City, Kansas fire.
Because it was right on state line.
It was number two Southwest Boulevard, Kansas City, Kansas, Conoco Filling Station and also Buck Station.
And there were films of the moment when the fire, the firemen were fighting the fire. They were kneeling down. There were the hoses spraying water. All of a sudden, the flames crossed Southwest Boulevard as if they were looking and just consumed it.
Right. The firefighters that you've seen in that film, they were 75 feet from this tank. The gasoline actually shot over them. You could actually see the raw gas coming and the flames coming after that, lighting this gas. It went 95 feet.
Gosh.
Now, you can see that I have this in some records at home in my many ideas and stuff that I've collected on the fire.
That fire went on to teach nationally. It became a national example to train firefighters, and even when I came on the fire department, that's an example that they taught us about the dangers of tank fires.
Lessons learned then, and also in the 1988 explosion out of the construction on US 71. Tell us about it and the lessons learned from it.
Well, the implementation of the hazardous materials team, and our city was pretty lax on placarding. And if you ever go to a building or see, you'll see placards on it. You know, the diamond shaped signs that are on different buildings or different containers. What that does is it gives us an indication of what's inside and what's burning. So if there's any explosives where we can see it coming up upon, you know, the incident, we can, oh, well, now we know that there's, you know, an explosive in there, a corrosive, whatever the case may be, and it informs us. And prior to that explosion, our city was not very, was pretty lax. I would say it's probably nationally was pretty lax on that. And, you know, had those guys known what was inside of the container, then they could have taken precautions.
It was a case of firefighters driving up to a rather plateau area where there was a
construction site, yeah,
filled with material, and they didn't know what was inside.
They had a couple car fires.
Mm-hmm.
After this happened, I was a captain at the time of this fire, and after this happened, any time there was going to be any kind of construction work within several miles of your fire station, you got paperwork telling you what was going to be on the site, where it was at, how it was going to be storage. You had to sign for that. Then also they suggested you go down and look at it. Now, that was going from one point to another point. They really got serious about it.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a lot of time out looking at buildings because I worked up north of the river where there was a lot of construction going on. But fortunately, we had no incidents like that.
Wow. Now, Pat writes us to us in an email, I'd like to know about firehouse watch boys that had to keep a lookout for smoke and sparks. I don't know about these.
A watch boy was a person that was assigned to an engine house. He could be as young as 14. He could be as old as 19 or 20. When he hit 21, he would probably become a member of the department. His job was basically to look after the fire station during the daytime hours. This meant opening and closing the doors for the firemen when they come and went, taking care of the stoves in the wintertime. And because those engine houses had more than one stove, there was probably at least two stoves on each floor. And these were where you had to go put the coal in by hand. And then at night, when they went out of the engine house, he got up and looked after the engine house until after they returned back from the fire.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was his job. They paid a salary in 1890 of about $15 a month.
When were watch boys phased out?
Watch boys were phased out sometime after 1905, 1906. They put the men on watch in the fire stations that we used to do. When we got the silent watch in 1970, everybody could go to bed. If they wanted us, they rang the bell and got us up.
And they did have some kind of pledge they gave?
Pardon?
Did the watch boys make some kind of, have to raise their right hand and say a pledge when they were hired on?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
I think they was more interested in making money just like anybody else was.
A lot of people are interested when they see fire trucks go by, and one question is, how are those numbers assigned on the trucks?
We wish we know, too.
Well, they were I think it started in just numerical order, and the numbers are assigned with the stations. So if you had station two, you'd have a pump or two inside station two. And then you went down through the hook and ladder numbers the same way. But throughout the years, as the city changed and the needs of the communities where the fire trucks were based changed, they may relocate a fire truck. So now you've got, well, for example, you'll have Truck 8, which is out by the old Bannister Mall. You know, it started downtown. It started at Old Station 5 at 11th and Troost. And as the needs of that community changed and the number of hook and ladders needed in that area changed, they moved it. And they moved it to Waldo. Then they moved it out to Bannister. So that's why you'll see lower numbers in different parts of the city, because they closed down here and they moved that company someplace else. But I think initially it was just numerical order.
Right. I can tell you this about the numbering system. From the beginning in 1868 to November the 11th of 1872, there was no numbers on the fire station. This was changed by a chief by the name of Silvers. He started the numbering, and he started in the West Bottoms with number 1. Number 2 was at 14 East Missouri Avenue. Number 3 was 12th and Walnut. And from there on, they just went up by the number system. The chief of the department had a say-so in how this numbering system would go, but it stayed that way for many a years. And what Jimmy says, yes, there's one real question they asked. We have a fire station number 7, but 9 pumper and 6 truck are in it, and people want to know why isn't that away? Well, there's a story behind that, too.
So for you fire department record keepers out there, there you are. That's all the time we have for today's show. Our guests have been Ray Elder, historian of the Kansas City Fire Department, Jimmy Walker, a battalion chief and vice president of the Kansas City Fire Historical Society, and Matt Stegall, a firefighter and a union official. Thanks, all of you, for being with us today. You can listen to this program again, subscribe to our podcast, or listen to any of our previous programs on the Central Standard page of kcur.org. Central Standard will be back Monday with a look at the Dust Bowl. Up to Date is next with a look at a universe of performing arts in Kansas City, a new dance collaboration, the Planet Symphony, and the Local Listen. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with Ross Steinmetz. I'm Monroe Dodd. This is KCUR, and enjoy your weekend.